Following on the heels of Martin Luther King Day on January 21st, February is Black History Month. This time of year, we talk about race almost as an annual matter, of course, but the realities of being black in America and in Western Wisconsin don't end on the last day of the month. Neither should the conversation. Thank you for tuning in this Monday morning on the Ideas Network stations here in Western Wisconsin. I'm Rich Kramer. Three guests join me to consider Martin Luther King and Black History Month, what it's like to experience Western Wisconsin as a black person, and efforts to bridge differences and unite people across race all year long. My guests today include Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, who joins us by phone for the first part of the hour. She is professor of history at UW-Eau Claire, and her teaching interests include U.S. social history, African-American history, and military history. She is active with the local chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as Uniting Bridges, which organizes the annual Martin Luther King Jr. And Juneteenth celebrations in Eau Claire. Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, welcome back to the West Side.
Thank you.
Good to have you. And joining me in the studio, we have Burl Middleton. He directs Uniting Bridges of Eau Claire, an organization that works toward building racial understanding and unity within the community through education. Again, Uniting Bridges organizes Eau Claire's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Remembrance and Juneteenth celebrations. Burl Middleton, welcome back to the West Side.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And Michael Thomas is the Student Services Coordinator at the Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. He serves as co-advisor for the Black Student Alliance, which recently opened the Black Cultural Center. He also coordinates Black History Month activities, including the upcoming February 6th Martin Luther King Jr. celebration on campus. Michael Thomas, welcome to the West Side.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Listeners, we always want to hear from you as well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. We have a phone line open. What are your observations or experiences with race in Western Wisconsin? Do you attend one or more of the Martin Luther King Jr. or Black History Month events? What needs to be done year-round to make the Chippewa Valley more inclusive? Let us know by calling 1-800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. So, something motivated each of you to get into your respective lines of work. So, if you could very quickly talk about your path that got you to where you are now, and where their personal experiences were there personal experiences that sparked your interest in working directly on issues relating to education and community building around racial understanding. Michael Thomas, I'll start with you.
Yes. So for me, what prompted me to be involved in higher education, specifically in student services, came from my own undergraduate experiences. And so I went to and graduated from a historically black college and university, the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. And so you can imagine that was a different experience going to a HBCU versus, you know, a PWI and working in that context. So being at an HBCU, I always had a support system in terms of the faculty and staff that were there, the student organizations that were present, and that really helped me be successful as a college student. And so those experiences and those memories and those moments really inspired me to actually go into higher education and work in this field to help support student success and help students imagine possibilities and really inspire and motivate them to be the strongest version of themselves, so academically, socially, and just to let them know that the sky's the limit. And so there is a context present here if we're considering the sociopolitical context in which education is which education sits in. And so I know that in this country, Black African Americans and other minoritized groups haven't always had the opportunity to excel educationally. Mm-hmm. And so that in itself reinforces strong interest and a commitment to this type of work to really ensure that people have a voice, and not only have a voice, but that it's being heard and that action steps are being taken to realize those opportunities and dreams for people.
Thank you for that. And I want to follow up with a question. So when you were looking to get into the job market, did you you know, did you want to take that experience with you to places that may not have had similar demographics to what you exposed or what you went through when you were in college, basically up here where,
yeah,
you know, there's a different breakdown?
Absolutely. And so when I think about, you know, doing the job market, I've pretty much could have, you know, applied to and started working at other historically black colleges and universities. But I do know that the black student experience is very different from a PWI versus an HBCU for all types of reasons, right? And so seeing that difference, but also wanting to gain that experience to see what it's like working in a different educational institution.
PWI, I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that acronym.
Predominantly white institution.
Okay. Yes. Thanks, Michael and Salika. Salika, how about yourself? You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what brought you to, you know, be so involved with organizing these events on campus and also, you know, your field of your major.
Well, I grew up in a segregated neighborhood in Louisiana, but I integrated my Catholic school. I went to, so there were very few people at that school. That was a predominantly white environment.
Uh-huh.
I went to my father's junior high school, which was integrated. At that time in 1980, 81 in Louisiana, it's still in the 80s, the academic magnets were still segregated in New Orleans. So I went to the black academic magnet, McDonough 35.
Mm-hmm.
After my father passed in 81, my mother felt she needed her PhD. She took us to Ohio, where I went to another predominantly white institution, Upper Arlington, Ohio, Upper Arlington High School,
mm-hmm.
Where we had 4 black people out of 2,000 in that high school.
Wow.
Went to Ohio State, worked for the military for a defense contractor, came here. So I've worked in all black and in predominantly white environments. My mother was a professor at Southern University in New Orleans, which is a historically black college.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up within the historically black college environment. Both of my parents went to historically black colleges. I'm the only one in my family who got her undergraduate degree from a predominantly white institution.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that experience, I've always had to be a bridge. And because I teach history, the minute I set foot in Eau Claire, I wound up with Black History Month. And just by being here, I've been forced out into the community. So I've been here 25 years, and now I have the networks around me that allow me to work with people to help resolve racial issues. And I have enough experience in talking across race. I'm not going to say I'm an expert, because I still have times where I look at people cross-eyed and go, what? But
I think we all experience that.
I have enough experience that I get to help people, and getting to help people is a true privilege.
Well, I wanted to follow up with you, too. You know, you mentioned that you were kind of forced into this role. So do you find that, you know, in hindsight, was it a blessing or was it a bit of a curse for you?
I'd say both. I mean, my husband, by being up here, is in the same position. We integrate the place by walking into the place.
Mm-hmm.
And my children are in the same situation. They have never known another environment. We have to operate in this environment. So we've had to learn how to make people comfortable around us.
Sure.
We've had to learn how to negotiate certain situations that will be very uncomfortable, and to watch very carefully to see who is safe and who is not. So it's a blessing in that it's opened opportunities for me that people in a predominantly black environment would not have had. On the other hand, it means that I have to be more careful, and I deal with more stressors and probably more discrimination than someone, say, living in a predominantly black space in Milwaukee.
Sure.
But it's a different type of discrimination. I'm less worried about the police shooting me on sight here, mm-hmm. which is your big worry in Milwaukee, you know, police brutality. Here, I'm more worried about being denied opportunities because of covert racism. Mm.
Well, I want to get more into that in just a bit here. Let's go to Burl Middleton. So, Burl, tell us, you know, what motivated you to get involved with Uniting Bridges?
Well, basically, my background is that I was born in the South, mm-hmm. in Arkansas, mm-hmm. and raised in the North. So I had the conduit was obviously the experiences of living in both types of situations. I lived in a neighborhood that was basically diverse for the most part, Jewish, Catholic, white, black, Hispanic. But what I did notice is that as people, there's a certain unanimity with being poor, and as people each of those groups progressed, they moved out of the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and so the neighborhoods obviously became predominantly one or the other, mm-hmm. and in this case it was predominantly black. I then went to I decided that I would do school choice before school choice was available in Milwaukee.
Interesting.
I decided that I would go to a predominantly white school. Because the opportunities were much better for a college education, and at that time in the '60s, you would see on TV the TV advertisements of a black mind is a terrible thing to waste, et cetera, and so forth from the United Negro College Fund, and I always wanted, you know, to go to college. So how could I do that? No one from my neighborhood was going to college.
Sure.
So that was something that, in terms of education, was a very extremely interesting and a curiosity for me. Mm-hmm. I did eventually do that because of the fact of the matter that education is, I think, a way out of getting, particularly being impoverished. And in this case here, I was had the opportunity to go to a school, Carroll College, which is now Carroll University, which was known as Harvard of the Midwest or Oxford on the Fox. So that was uplifting.
Yeah.
To achieve something. And so as far as, you know, my role now, I look at the achievements. I look at people looking to provide opportunities for others by way of how they themselves got those opportunities. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I'm sure we're going to talk about him in a moment, certainly looked at the legacy of an improvement. He certainly said that, you know, during his lifetime, he would not see those types of improvements. We simply want to see those small increments during our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Uniting Bridges means to me at this point.
Very good. Thank you for that. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. I'm speaking with Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at UW-Eau Claire, Burl Middleton, director of Uniting Bridges of Eau Claire, and Michael Thomas, student services coordinator, Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. Phone lines are wide open. We're talking about race in Western Wisconsin and all of the different factors that play into, you know, what is the black experience in Western Wisconsin in an area that is predominantly white. 1-800-228-5615. About Martin Luther King Jr. He's arguably the most recognized figurehead when it comes to black history in the United States. He's the only black leader the U.S. recognizes with a federal holiday. So I'm wondering, how does the intense focus on King affect our understanding of black history? Or is it even possible that it narrows understanding a bit by fitting black history into like a small box? You know what I'm trying to get at. So let's start with the Burl Middleton.
Well, I think that the greatest legacy of Dr. King was the legacy that he's left with us that we continue to see, and that is that each of us now realizes and recognizes what is right. Mm-hmm. And that was the major focus. It doesn't matter about color. It doesn't matter about race. It doesn't matter about age and sex and those types of things. It is what is right, how to treat a fellow man or fellow woman right. And I think that for the most part, Dr. King had had a vision, as I mentioned earlier, that preceded anything that he would ever see in his lifetime. So we're continuing to try to work on those types of things. And we now have to envision, what does it look like moving forward for each of us? What does it look like
right.
for each of us? His vision was one. That vision can be recognized in certain aspects. But now, with those of us who are still here, because he's no longer here, it didn't stop. His vision didn't stop simply with his death. It far preceded that. And again, I think that is what his legacy really is.
And it's an incredible legacy. And it's looked up to, you know, universally. So, Michael Thomas, you know, there are other black leaders that had big impact on the civil rights movement or you know, black empowerment. You've got Malcolm X, there's Harriet Tubman, et cetera. The list goes on, but they don't have their own specific day. So do you think that there's anything to the possibility that, you know, we have this month, we have this day that people kind of want to, you know, put it all into a box and then, you know, the rest of the year we feel good and we don't have to talk about it? Do you think there's a danger there?
Absolutely. If that's the direction in which people are going as far as thoughts regarding the impact of Dr. King's legacy and other black leaders who have contributed significantly to civil rights and different contributions on behalf of the black community. I think, yes, we have a month that we celebrate black history in. But for me, Black History Month is 365 days out of the year. And so I always tell people, actually, this month is just our anniversary, so to speak.
Oh, I like that.
Because when you are black, living in America, you do that 365 days out of the year. So that's an everyday lived experience versus something that, oh, we're going to pay attention to for the shortest day of the month, mind you,
yeah.
For that time. And so I think that it does become an issue if people only understand, okay, we're going to do Black History Month, almost like it's checking off a box, so to speak, and not really kind of getting into the talents and the contributions that many black people, unnamed leaders especially, who don't necessarily get a specific day like Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. We do recognize that he's been a profound leader within the movement for civil rights and has done enormous things on behalf of that idea movement. But it does become dangerous when we lose the other voices that were also present in helping him push forward and making that reality possible today. Yes, we still have a lot. We have a ways to go, so to speak. We have a ways to go, but there are things that have been realized since he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And so in remembrance, we, you know, take that memory and apply it to our own individual day-to-day activities and understanding that although we might not hold the title of, let's say, president of the United States or a principal or a significant position, that we all are leaders in our own right. And so it's really a reimagining of what can you do in service of, so mm-hmm. to speak. So,
Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, I want to bring you in on this. Do you think there's a possibility that the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King is celebrated, you know, universally in America history as because he was maybe a safer figure than, say, a Malcolm X? You know, the Dr. King was so straightforward and was always intent on keeping, you know, protests nonviolent, et cetera. But then you've got other people. Malcolm X, he was a little more aggressive in his message, and also you've got, you know, the rise of the Black Panthers, and that really, in when I was learning about the 60s and the 70s in college, there seemed to be quite a reaction to the Black Panthers, and today even there's a lot of people that think of that group as a terrorist group of sorts. So do you think there's a safeness in Dr. King, you know, that
Not really. I mean, when I was on Converge Radio doing music for them, one of the songs I pulled was By the Time I Get to Arizona. There are people who really do see Martin Luther King still to this day as a threat.
Huh.
And it's because of the three leaders, to be honest, Martin Luther King is the most revolutionary, and he's the most radical, and he was the most threatening to white supremacists. And it was his reasonableness and his message that actually made him the most threatening.
Mm.
The Panthers, I mean, I've seen the Klan try to co-opt the Panthers, which I think is hilarious. The Panthers are seen as terrorists merely because of their style. More violence was done to the Panthers than they ever did to anybody. They never engaged in offensive violence. They were physically attacked, and I'll be honest, if you look at Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, none of the charges against them, including murder charges, have ever been upheld.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, look at, when you look at the people around that, you really, with the Panthers, saw state-sponsored suppression of speech and abuse of power. But Hoover saw King as his biggest threat, and as the biggest threat to white supremacy. In the process of getting the King holiday, King, there are people who have tried to take the King legacy and defang it. There are people who have tried to create it, to make it a political football, in the same reason, in the same way that people abuse Christianity, that people abuse anything to try to get power. King argued for a nonviolence that was provocative. He argued for direct action. And the direct action of the sit-ins and the marches and the bus boycott were as aggravating to supremacists then as taking over highways and Colin Kaepernick's taking a knee today. It was as divisive. I've gone through letters to the editor at the New York Times, and there were people screaming that King was a communist for wanting equality. So I think that while we have seen a sanitized King, what I try to do at the Martin Luther King program is show the other King, the one who was angry, the one who was realistic, and the one who was challenging people to be better. And that's not a comfortable King in many ways. I mean, my students, my white students actually find Malcolm X easier to deal with than Martin Luther King. Because if you look at the six principles of nonviolence, the fourth one, which is to be forgiving of your enemies, and which claims there's redemption in sacrifice, that's really hard. Malcolm's call for armed self-defense makes a lot more sense. It's not an offensive argument. Everyone has a right to self-defense. Although some people seem to think black people don't have a right to self-defense, everyone has a right to self-defense. So that's easy for my students to engage.
Sure, that makes sense. That's an interesting point. So you mentioned the event that was held in Eau Claire at the St. James the Greater Catholic Church on the 21st. So what was the theme of that event, Salika? And if you could, you know, what did you take away from this year's program? Because you've been doing it for some years now.
Yeah, this is the 10th year that I've directed.
I like that laugh. That laugh says a lot.
Well, it's always been a learning experience. I think Burl will attest to that, won't you, Burl?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This year the theme was voting. The speech was the ballot, the name, that was the featured speech. But what was ironic was, what's ironic is that his words were still very relevant today. Martin Luther King was telling liberals and conservatives that they were screwing up. He bashed both parties. He argued for a government that's more responsive to people and not to corporate sponsors. If you listen to that speech today, you could assume Reverend Barber had given it. Anyone could have given it today, and it would have looked absolutely relevant and absolutely modern. So I think, too, we had the largest crowd we've ever had. We had 683 people.
Yeah.
And the event's getting bigger every year, and I think it has become a place where people can come to be with like-minded people, to find community, to work with these partner organizations that we have, and to have a moment where we can be with each other in peace.
It was a very nice event. Producer, WPR producer Catherine Thomas and I visited this year, and it was really neat seeing the kids read the, you know, take turns reading the speech. Some were more versed at reading speech than others, but either way, it struck me because it, I mean, it's, you can hear these speeches, you've heard parts of it, not the full one, but you hear these things all the time, but hearing it out of the mouth of a child was an interesting, it had an interesting impact. So why is that important, Burrell?
Well, this is why the legacy continues to live on. You know, as Dr. Duxworth Lawton just pointed out, you know, we still have some resistance, you know, in every community. And she talked about, you know, just the Martin Luther King Jr. Day resistance. If you think about that, I mean, let's just do a quick comparative analysis between the two in terms of Juneteenth and Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The Juneteenth situation was one that was obviously advocated for a long period of time.
Yeah.
But only after many people recognized, you know, what the outcome possibly could be. As a result of that, actually a prelude to that was the, well, we know it was the Civil War, and the Civil War with slavery. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1863 is when the Emancipation Proclamation came forward. The slaves weren't really free until 1865. That's 2 years. If you look at Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Martin Luther King Jr. Day was by President Reagan was 1983. It wasn't actually enacted in terms of an actual celebration until 1986, 3 years.
Wow.
So you actually politicize, you know, these dates. So when these children come forward, they actually are the identification of what we see as the actual progress, as opposed to what political you know, conduits, you know, want to proclaim is actually what's happening. And those aren't the actuality. So what Dr. Lawton does is fantastic in terms of bringing those kids forward, bringing those children forward, and actually having them recognize, you know, what they're actually doing, because they're not just reading things.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually understanding what those messages are.
Yeah, and helping the audience understand it better as well. With that, let's take our first break here. We're learning more about how the region celebrates Black History Month and what community members and institutions are doing to promote racial inclusivity. Our guests include Burrell Middleton, Director of Uniting Bridges, Michael Thomas, Student Services Coordinator at the Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire, and Dr. Salika Duxworth Lawton, Professor of History at UW-Eau Claire. They're going to stick with us. I know that Salika has to leave in just a bit, but she's going to be with us for the discussion as long as possible, and I'm going to hold her to that. I'm Rich Kramer. This is the West Side on the Ideas Network stations of Western Wisconsin. Those are 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. We can take your call at 1-800-228-5615. Join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Home Builders Association. The annual Home and Garden Show comes to the YMCA Indoor Sports Center February 22nd through the 24th. Ticket information is at cvhomebuilders.com.
Welcome back to the West Side. The Super Bowl yesterday attracted thousands of football fans to Atlanta. Each year it also attracts, that is, we're talking about Black History Month events in our area on the West Side today. I was previewing a program for next week. My apologies for that. Today we're talking about Black History Month and events in Eau Claire, also the overall discussion of race and what it's like to be part of a minority group living in Western Wisconsin and the state as a whole. We're going to talk a bit about an event coming up this week at February 6th. There's a Martin Luther King Jr. celebration at UW-Eau Claire. We're also looking into the racial climate here in the Western Wisconsin region and how the community is working toward greater racial understanding. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you. We're joined by Burl Middleton, Director of Uniting Bridges, and Michael Thomas, Student Services Coordinator in the Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, Professor of History at UW-Eau Claire, joins us by phone for just a bit longer. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us. 1-800-228-5615. We've got phone lines open for you, and we are equipped. Are we equipped as a community to discuss race openly? What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-228-5615. So I wanted to talk, you know, Salika mentioned voting, and that was the theme of the event in January. So right now, I mean, it's so apropos. Right now, there is a lawsuit between members, you know, the in Wisconsin that has to do with attempts to limit early voting that were passed in a lame duck session by the Republican majority. And so, Salika, just, you know, you mentioned that this is, those words spoken by Dr. King could, you know, you could hear them today, and if you didn't know any better, you'd think that it was ripped from the headlines. So, I mean, how does it feel from your perspective? You know, we see all these news stories about, well, limits to voting and et cetera generally affect, you know, minority populations more and also people from lower socioeconomic status. But, you know, people that come from places of privilege might not feel it the same way. So what does it feel like when you hear or see measures like this passed either in Wisconsin or elsewhere in the country?
Well, I'm on the executive board. I'm the Chippewa Valley representative to the executive board of the Wisconsin ACLU.
Right.
So I signed the letter to the State House saying don't do this, because the right to vote is the sacrosanct vote right that really protects every other right in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And voter suppression is one of the worst things that you can see. I teach Jim Crow, and voter suppression was the heart of Jim Crow. There's no good reason for these behaviors other than power, and we need to start thinking about this in terms of power. We also need to start thinking about it in terms of accountability, because the fewer people vote, the easier it is for politicians to do what they want and act against our interests. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's on either side. Voter suppression will hit both parties. So the words of King still ring for me today. I also grew up in a segregated South right after the Civil Rights Movement. I'm in that first generation. Mm-hmm. And I remember when David Duke was running for governor, and finally all of these old black people came out to register. We asked them why they hadn't registered before. This is 1990. And they said they were afraid. They were afraid to vote because they were afraid of the Klan. Mm-hmm. So there's a link in my mind between voter suppression and supremacy and corruption, and that it's a link that comes with Jim Crow. It's also linked to mass incarceration, because the less, say, ordinary people have in electing the people who represent us, the less, say, we actually have in how crime is defined and what the law does. So there's a number of people who think we're overregulated today. They think that things like public urination should not even be a ticket. You look at New York, where giving someone a single cigarette is a crime. And that comes from politicians who have suppressed the vote so much that you can criminalize things that are not crimes, and you can put people in jail and use their labor for free.
Well, that actually leads me to another set of questions for you. I mean, you're involved with the ACLU's Smart Justice Program. So if you could kind of give us an idea of what that is, you know, and also when we were heading into a new gubernatorial election, there was this discussion over prison reforms, and it's certainly not only specific to black people, but, you know, all sorts of people affected by, you know, the experience of getting into the system and having trouble making it more difficult for them to succeed elsewhere in life. So can you tell us a little bit about that, and with regards to, you know, the prison reform promises that we've heard, you know, cutting the prison population in Wisconsin in half. It's a goal that, that the governor said he wants to strive for.
Well, this gets to that we need to look at what we are putting our resources in. We should be putting more law enforcement resources into serious crimes like dealing with meth, with big meth dealers, dealing with big coke dealers, and less with crimes that aren't less serious. You look at crimeless revocation, which is where someone on bail is sent back to jail, not for breaking the law, but for maybe associating with a relative who also has a, who has also had a felony, for taking a job without talking to their parole officer. For there's a number of things that we do ordinarily every day, someone on parole is limited from, and that's a waste of Wisconsin money. Wisconsin has more people incarcerated right now, more black people incarcerated, than any other state in the United States. And the majority of those are for crimeless revocation. If we can go back and look at this crimeless revocation issue, if we can also look at some of what I was talking about, the petty issues, the tickets that are winding up putting people in jail, then we can save a lot of money that we could actually move into K-12 education. We could fix our roads. How many people out there are complaining about the roads right now? The problem with the criminal justice system right now is it incentivizes pleading guilty to things people are not guilty of. And we have over-regulated our life. If you engage in self-defense now, you're going to have to put out $5,000 to get a lawyer to keep yourself from going to jail. How many people have $5,000 sitting around? You know, it's we have regulated life to the point where we don't, in actuality, have a right to self-defense.
Well, and with that, Salika, I know that you've got to prepare for a class, so I want to thank you very much for joining us for the discussion today and for all the work that you do with, you know, the celebrations, the Martin Luther King, Juneteenth, all that. So we appreciate it, as always. Good luck with the class, and also good luck on those icy roads heading home today.
Thank you, and thank you, WPR, for all you do, and thank you specifically.
Oh, I appreciate it. Take care. So, Burl Middleton, you also work with the Department of Corrections in Wisconsin. So, you know, what's your perspective on this?
Well, you can legislate crime, and we do it all the time. If you look at the BALs, I mean, that's one of the easiest identifiers of how we can legislate criminals from .12 to a point
blood alcohol
0.01
levels. Sure,
yes,
sure.
To a .08 to, I mean,
seeing more people go into the system because of that.
Yes, we absolutely legislate that. I've seen individuals who've come in on a misdemeanor that turns into a felony because of revocations, and you know, I mean, those things are possible. And the reform and the overhaul of the criminal justice system is certainly something that is very serious, particularly for minorities and more specifically for black people. So in Florida recently, you probably have heard that they restored the voting rights for felons.
Yeah.
So that's a progressive state.
Well, I had heard that was... It was possible, but it was almost impossible. That even now with reforms, that it's still not as easy as just, you know.
Well, it isn't, because you're still going to identify certain types of groups.
Sure.
For instance, even in Florida, sex offenders are still not eligible for voting, so they still have no rights.
Right.
Again, I mean, if you think of the word itself, voting rights, that's what our forefathers actually wanted us to have, those rights. Rights are not taken away, so it becomes a privilege. And, of course, as Dr. Lawton pointed out, with Jim Crow, a lot of privileges became suspect in terms of who they would be available to and who they would not be available to. And, of course, that led to the ability to actually to vote, because if you didn't own a certain amount of land, you had no voting rights. And so, again, there's a woman by the name of Michelle Alexander who talks about the new Jim Crow. In fact, I think that's the name of her book, The New Jim Crow. And it talks about the mass incarceration that we have in this country of how to suppress and to repress people so that they don't have a stock in making decisions for their welfare.
With that, we have to take our final break here on the West Side. We're talking about Black History Month as celebrated in Western Wisconsin, along with efforts to make our region more inclusive, a welcoming place for Black community members all year round. Our guests are, for the rest of the hour, Burl Middleton. He's director of Uniting Bridges, and Michael Thomas. He is student services coordinator in the Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, professor of history at UW-Eau Claire, joined us by phone earlier in this program, but she had to get ready for a class, so we are going to let her do that. So I'm Rich Kramer. Stay tuned as we pick up our discussion right after this. If you've got a question or a comment, feel free to give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. We have three open phone lines, so if you call in, we'll be able to get you right on the air. 1-800-228-5615. This is The West Side.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department. Support also comes from Farley's House of Pianos, hosting the intimate Salon Piano Series concerts, with pianist Ilya Yakushev playing Mozart, Beethoven, Schumann, and more, February 23rd, salonpianoseries.org.
Stepping Stones of Dunn County holds its Empty Bowls fundraiser Saturday, March 2nd, and encourages civic, educational, and social groups to contribute their creative talent making and decorating bowls. To set up a session, email foodpantry@steppingstonesdc.org.
What do you do when your computer, tablet, or smartphone doesn't work? Coming up next hour on Larry Mueller. He will talk with Peter Green about how to find the problem, what resources are available to help fix it, and how to find a support person. That's after 11 o'clock this morning on the Ideas Network. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about Black History Month, Dr. Martin Luther King, and the legacy of trying to improve racial inclusivity in Western Wisconsin. I'm Rich Kramer. Joining me are two guests here to talk with us for the rest of the hour. Burl Middleton is director of Uniting Bridges, and Michael Thomas is student services coordinator in the Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call. If you have a question or comment for our guests, have you attended the UW-Eau Claire Martin Luther King Jr. celebration? You know, why do you go? Why is it important for you to make sure and keep this issue and this man at the top of mind in your daily life? Give us a call, 1-800-228-5615. So Michael Thomas, as a student services coordinator and co-advisor for the Black Student Alliance at UW-Eau Claire, you're responsible for helping plan campus activities during Black History Month. And we have on, well, let's see, I don't have my watch right in front of me, but on February 6th at Schofield Auditorium, there's a celebration for Martin Luther King Jr. So can you tell us a little bit about what to expect there?
So before going into some of those details, I think it's also important to note that this on-campus MLK celebration was in response to a specific request from a lot of the African-American Black students on campus who wanted a program on campus upon their return from winter break.
Okay.
So that provides just some context for that, because I know we do have one in the community,
right,
that also takes place during the time where a lot of students aren't present. So that's kind of like the history behind that.
That
and
makes
so
sense.
For this celebration program, this is the second one that we're doing. And so we're very happy to continue to build upon the success of last year with the program. And what people can expect at this celebratory event is different musical performances, different awards, different lineups, a keynote address. And so, and actually who will be given the keynote address this year is civil rights leader Joanne Bland. Mm-hmm. And so really, we really are looking forward to a very re-energizing program to really help us take the words of Dr. King and like put it into action into our day-to-day lives and the things that we do, not only for student success, but in our personal lives too, as productive members of society. So I don't want to give too many details about it. It's, you know, expect a very great program. It's going to be different than last year. One of the things we always work on, because it was well received last year. And so we are always like, okay, how do we continue that wow factor? How do we have something that's different? And so we've achieved that, and we certainly hope people come out to the celebration.
And that is February 6th at 5 p.m. at Schofield Auditorium?
Yes.
All right. We have our first caller of the morning, and we're going to go to Cynthia. Cynthia in Menominee, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
You're welcome. I'm a retiree from UW-Eau Claire and worked in the university system for 35 years. And your guests today are an excellent explanation of, or an example of, why we need diversity on our campuses. There's too many people that would not be exposed to these issues if we did not have these wonderful campus members that work with the local community to explain diversity, keep our eyes open. We need more diversity. We need the guarantee that we see the reality.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. So, I mean, putting on these events is no small task. It's as Salika mentioned, it's kind of a role that she felt like she was kind of thrust into just by the very nature of everything. So there you have, you know, at least one person. I'm sure there's been hundreds that have thanked you all for the work that you do on this. But just again, why is it important to get it out there? I mean, no matter what the turnout is at these events, like, it's just keeping it forefront. Front of mind, Burl Middleton?
Well, it's extremely important. a few years ago, we attempted to develop a racial justice task force within the city of Eau Claire.
Okay.
And that's when I was on the city council. There was a lot of pushback for that, quite a bit of pushback, in fact. Many elements of the community simply did not want to face the fact of the matter that there was discrimination, there was racism, and there were these types of ills within our community. You know, and Eau Claire is a very beautiful community. And no one wants their community to have and to harbor these types of situations where they're frowned upon. So it is important to keep these, like the caller, like Cynthia mentioned, it's important to keep these things in the forefront. We focus at Uniting Bridges on the educational academic portion of what we do as a community organization. And we're very happy to be partnered with the university to make sure that this is the pathway by which this information continues to flow.
1-800-228-5615. We can probably take one or two more questions if you've got, if you call in, 800-228-5615. Michael Thomas, I wanted to talk to you about something that's relatively new, but it's some months now, but we've got a new multicultural, or a new cultural black cultural center on campus. So what went into that? And also, if you could just speak, I believe it's around 10% of the student population is black, or not even, we're not there yet?
Not quite there yet.
Is that there was a goal, I know, that the chancellor had made.
Yes,
so tell us, you know, how do those students that might be coming from outside of state, maybe from other parts where it's where they're not in such a minority, feel on campus? Because there was an issue back in 2016 where there was something scrawled on this free speech board. I mean, there was the rally on campus that caused some discomfort. So can you kind of walk us through that?
Well, so I've been in this position for 2 years now. So I arrived in the spring of 2017,
okay.
So right before that big rally and everything happened. But just to give some context to the UWC Black student experience, so you're looking at about Black students representing just about 1% of the student population.
Oh, 1%.
So that's a really, really small number. And a lot of our Black students are coming from inner cities like, you know, Chicago, Milwaukee, in those areas. And so coming into, again, a predominantly white institution, that experience can be shocking for a lot of students if their whole experience has been with their own backgrounds and identities. And so that transition can be rough, especially for minoritized and Black students. As far as the UWC Black Cultural Center is concerned, this really emerged out of a need to provide a request, a direct service for students. So thinking about what their experiences are on campus and not really having a necessarily safe space to be in community with and build upon relationships with each other. And I know a lot of people have misconceptions around the creation of a UWC Black Culture Center, and that a lot of people think that students are essentially segregating themselves for the wider campus. But that's an interesting concept, too, because you can't really segregate yourself on a predominantly white institution because everywhere they're, you know, predominantly white people. And so it's what it is. And there's a lot of research that supports this in terms of cultural centers, the relevancy to student success. It really helps them be able to provide community with each other and build upon their experiences to really uplift and support each other. So it's not that they're segregating at all.
So, you know, that I can understand where someone would have that thought that maybe that's what's going on. But was there other pushback to this idea?
As far as, you know, the whole segregation piece, this idea that that's not what we, you know, as an institution, we're not trying to segregate students. And so it's really a matter of like educating and being an advocate about like what the needs of students are, especially as we look at higher education and trends and how things change, and really trying to be a supporting system for our students in the best way possible.
Bro Middleton, you get the last word here. So moving forward, you know, what do you see for the future of, you know, racial inclusivity in Western Wisconsin? And you got 30 seconds.
Well, one of the things I would say, Rich, is first of all, the community in Eau Claire. So, I mean, we have a luxury here. We were the third city in the state to actually begin Juneteenth Day. Mm-hmm. So we have a luxury here. When I was elected to the city council, it wasn't by a populist Black vote. It was a diverse group of people. And so come out to these events. And when you see them, stay tuned and stay alert and stay informed.
And learn. Thank you so much. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, Professor of History at Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at UW-Eau Claire, Burl Middleton, Director of Uniting Bridges, Michael Thomas, Student Services Coordinator, Office of Multicultural Affairs at UW-Eau Claire. Catherine Thomas produced this hour. Mort Cypress was our producer, but he stayed home because of the ice, so thanks anyway, Mort. Publicity for today's show was managed by Kate Spranger. I'm Rich Kramer. Tune in next week for another edition of The West Side, when we'll talk about sex trafficking in Western Wisconsin. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.